Has this ever happened to you? You wake up, look at your phone, scroll through the news for a minute or two, and then think, wow, how did we get here? Well, that's the question we tackle every week on NPR's Throughline podcast. We tell you the surprising stories of the people who made our history.
Carl Sagan was in people's living rooms talking about the wonders of the universe, making science feel personal and important to an everyday person.
Listen to Throughline from NPR, wherever you get your podcasts.
On Memorial Day, we honor American soldiers who made the ultimate sacrifice. There's one community now working to honor people who fought alongside the U.S.
What sets this memorial apart is that it's told from the perspective of Vietnamese.
Today on The World, stories of conflict and devotion and how they are told through memorials. I'm Marco Werman.
And I'm Carolyn Beeler. Some memorials can also generate conflict. Germans question whether to use small paving stones to remember Holocaust victims.
There really isn't a one-size-fits-all kind of answer to how to memorialize, and that's the important thing.
And in Taiwan, legends about some of the island's first inhabitants are proven through science.
They do not say, we were here first. They just say, we were here before you.
How we remember on this special Memorial Day edition of The World. This is The World. I'm Carolyn Beeler.
And I'm Marco Werman. We are glad you could be with us on this Memorial Day, a holiday dating back to the Civil War that began simply with flowers placed at the gravesites of soldiers. Today on the show, we'll be looking at the many ways we memorialize the dead as well as somber moments in history. We begin looking at another Civil War involving U.S. troops, the war in Vietnam.
It started in the 1950s between North and South Vietnam. When it ended half a century ago, more than 50,000 Americans had lost their lives. About 3 million Vietnamese combatants and civilians were killed.
In the weeks and decades that followed the war, hundreds of thousands of Vietnamese fled the country. They resettled across the U.S. in places like the Fields Corner neighborhood of Boston, now known as Little Saigon. Reporter Heidi Shin has the story of that community's efforts to create a different kind of Vietnam War memorial.
Hung Vu served as a lieutenant in the South Vietnamese Army in the 1970s. He was just a young man back then with a big vision for rebuilding Vietnam. But when Saigon fell in 1975, he became a political prisoner instead, and that hope was lost.
Qua một cái giai đoạn mà trước đây thì chúng tôi cũng là sĩ quan của chế độ cũ.
We're sitting at his kitchen table in Fields Corner. The wall behind the fridge is covered with I voted stickers and reminders for community meetings. He's come a long way since the communist reform period in Vietnam in the 1970s. He was sent to a re-education camp then, which was essentially a prison in the woods. The memories from that time still make him shudder. In the prison camp, Vu says he was subject to brutal forced labor, disease, hunger, for a sentence of 7 years. This because of his ties to the South Vietnamese government. I was lucky enough to make it out alive, he says. But some of his friends died in these labor camps. Eventually, Hung Vu was released. He and his family joined the nearly 800,000 Vietnamese who migrated to the U.S. in the 70s, 80s, and 90s.
Đi theo cái dạng gọi là HO, dạng nhân đạo.
He was granted a humanitarian HO visa as a labor camp survivor. Here in the U.S., Vietnam veterans are honored on national holidays. But these memorials don't mention the Vietnamese Americans who fought alongside the U.S. and then became U.S. citizens.
And I'm always at this site in Dorchester where there's 79 American soldiers' names, but no Vietnamese names. And so the trauma, the grief, the lived experience is still very much there.
That's Nhoc Tran Vu. She's Hung Vu's daughter and an artist in Boston. She and her colleague, Lin Phang Vu, set out to build a memorial, a public art installation that would tell stories like her dad's. It's a project called 1975, a Vietnamese diaspora commemorative initiative. And they say it won't just honor war veterans.
what sets this memorial apart is that it's told from the perspective of Vietnamese. It should shift it towards the impact of war on families and communities.
Tran Vu shows me around Townfield Park in Fields Corner, Boston. It's one of the potential sites for the new memorial, pending city approval. Nearby, there are pho noodle shops, bubble tea, a Buddhist temple, and triple-decker houses. This is one of the largest Vietnamese-American communities in the Northeast. Tran Vu tells me about plans for the memorial design. There are no war generals on horses here.
Intentionally, it's the banyan tree, which is also known as the ancient tree in Vietnam and Southeast Asia. So it's
unlike the typical war memorial, Tran Vu says this project is community-driven. The design team has been hosting meetings with local Vietnamese Americans across generations. And as it turns out, they don't always agree on a lot of things.
Our elders have lived through the war. Some are boat refugees themselves. They're like, we want the boat to be represented.
Whereas young people, largely born here and raised here in the U.S. as Vietnamese Americans, want something else.
And young people leaning towards more like the healing.
The representation of hope. In other words, they want to build a community identity that goes beyond war and trauma. Their politics and perspectives might be different from their parents. They want to focus on resilience and their new lives and how they contribute to American culture and the economy. The 1975 project will also include a collection of oral histories led by project director Lin Phuong Vu. She's an instructor at UMass Boston in the Asian American Studies program. And she's been working with her students who are second and third generation Vietnamese Americans to collect these stories.
Oftentimes they tell me that the Vietnam War is a small little section in the U.S. history textbook. It's very, they talk more about the humanitarian efforts.
So instead of meeting on the UMass campus, Lynn brings her students into Fields Corner, where we are now. Here, her students interview shopkeepers, community leaders, Vietnamese-American grandparents about being Vietnamese refugees.
These stories are literally blowing their minds about what the history actually really truly was.
A lot of those were the darker side of the stories, right?
Angelina Nguyen is a UMass student. She had an uncle who survived the labor camps, and her parents fled Vietnam by boat as teenagers.
Women who were on the boats would be robbed by pirates or raped at worst or thrown overboard even. And it was just a lot of horrific stories.
The elders they interview are like stand-ins for their own parents, who they may not hear these stories from. It helps them to humanize their parents and to understand their PTSD triggers.
There's this like gap that like we just couldn't understand each other. The fact that I'm able to understand them now, I'm able to give them that grace that I wasn't able to give them before.
The empathy that comes from these conversations can then be the start of healing. Lin Vu is also trained as a mental health clinician. And she knows that asking someone to tell a difficult story can actually re-trigger their trauma. So she's really careful about this process.
We don't just go in and collect these stories and say, okay, thank you, and then leave. We should be checking in. We're always check in. We are in the community.
Last month, Tran Vu and Lin Vu hosted an event to remember the fall of Saigon on April 30th, 1975. It's a day known as Black April. It was at a high school in Boston with hundreds of attendees, girls in white tunic dresses, elders in military uniform. Boston's Mayor Michelle Wu was there. There was music, dancing, art. Lin Vu and her students created an interactive exhibit using what they'd heard and learned to depict the various stages of a refugee's journey. Student Angelina Nguyen gives me a tour. As visitors enter the large, dark room, each is given a glass jar with lights to be used like a lantern. We pass through a dark tunnel of newspaper clippings from the war. We hear radio reports.
South Vietnam now is under communist control. The last president of Vietnam, General Minh, has been arrested.
We see a refugee suitcase.
Here it's items that people usually had to choose from, maybe jewelry or like gold for like currency.
A 10-foot escape boat, GI uniforms, a map where visitors can mark their own refugee journeys. Earlier, Tran Phu's father Hong Vu said that he wanted to protect his children from his past traumas. But now, after having shared these memories, he's changed his mind. He said he's relieved and happy. It gives him hope to see the work that young people are doing with all its possibilities. At the end of the tour, visitors add their small lanterns to a whole wall of jars illuminated with light. The exhibit seems to say it's possible to do both, to remember the war and to celebrate the strength and resilience of refugee and immigrant communities, to celebrate being Vietnamese American here in the U.S. For the world, I'm Heidi Shin, Fields Corner, Boston.
Memorials are not always places, museums, or statues. Sometimes music and dance are the vehicles that preserve and honor history and culture. We're going to take you now to Arica, a city in the north of Chile, for a carnival that happened earlier this year. Some 150,000 people showed up to honor Chilean indigenous groups, the Aymara, Quechua, and Afro-Chilean communities. Michael Fox brought us to the heart of the festivities.
A shaman stands on the street corner of a working-class neighborhood. His hands are in the air. He's making an offering to Pachamama, Mother Earth. On the ground, herbs and coca leaves are laid out on a colorful blanket. The shaman throws incense on the flames of a small fire and pours alcohol and wine on the four cardinal points, each time asking for Mother Earth's blessing and guidance. This is a ceremony to mark the beginning of carnival for the Tobas Andino Sajama Guerreros folk dance troupe. 33-year-old Diego Maldonado is one of the leaders. He's been dancing since he was 10.
Bueno, para nosotros que somos Aymara, que llevamos ya tiempo bailando.
For those of us who are Aymara, who have been dancing for a long time and who learned this from our grandparents and from our ancestors, this is really important, he says. We learned this from the cradle. We watched our parents and our grandparents practicing these traditions before us. It's necessary and it's important. The Aymara are the second largest indigenous group in Chile. Their central homeland is in the highlands of Bolivia, but they've lived in what is now Chile and southern Peru since pre-Columbian times. As of 2015, they made up almost a third of the population of the province of Arica. This carnival is largely a celebration of Aymara indigenous identity. Paulo Noya Matos' family is from Bolivia, but he grew up here in Arica.
El carnaval vendría siendo un rescate de las descendencias bolivianas.
This carnival is like a revival of Bolivian heritage, says Noya Matos. It celebrates and validates Andean culture. It transcends borders and makes you feel part of Andean culture. Noya Matos is performing in a tarqueada dance group. They march with thick, long wooden flutes. They say their song calls for the rains this time of the year, planting time in the region. Nearly 80 different dance troupes are performing over the next 3 days. Each has a different style, look, music, and significance. But they're all tied to Mother Earth and celebrating people's connection to their indigenous roots. That is no small feat in a country that pushed Chilean nationalism and assimilation throughout the 20th century. Noya Matos says that before there was a lot of discrimination against Peruvian, Bolivian, and Aymara cultures. He says he himself faced a ton of discrimination growing up for being of Bolivian descent. But times are changing. Lilibeth Diaz and Judith Mamani are dancing the Morenada. They wear huge smiles and extravagant yellow cholita dresses. We dance with our hearts. We sing with everything we have because these are our roots, says Judith Mamani. We give everything we have in this carnival because we carry it in our blood. Afro-Chilean dance and culture has also taken center stage at the carnival. Black communities have a long history in Arica. Spanish colonizers forced African descendants to work the land here for hundreds of years. Together, all of these groups are standing up for their identities and celebrating their ancestry. For the world, I'm Michael Fox, Arica, Chile.
Coming up, traditions and stories of indigenous people in Taiwan may now be confirmed by new archaeological finds. You're listening to The World.
You come to the New Yorker Radio Hour for conversations that go deeper with people you really want to hear from, whether it's Bruce Springsteen or Questlove or Olivia Rodrigo, Liz Cheney, or the godfather of artificial intelligence, Geoffrey Hinton, or some of my extraordinarily well-informed colleagues at The New Yorker. So join us every week on The New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.
This is The World. I'm Carolyn Beeler. The first Chinese settlers arrived on the islands of Taiwan 400 years ago. Indigenous populations had already been living there for ages. For generations, they've told stories of their ancestors that were often assumed to be myths. But new archaeological evidence is emerging about one of those groups. Today, we're looking at the many ways history is remembered and honored around the world. For this story, reporter Ashish Valentine takes us to the mountains of northern Taiwan, the home of the Saisiat.
I'm only a 3 hours drive from the bustle of Taipei, but it feels like another world. The air's cool and misty, but thick with smoke from ritual fires and the fermented tang of homemade millet wine. Dozens of people lock arms as they dance in a giant circle. But they're not alone. The Saisiat believe we're surrounded by spirits known as the Kokota'ai, a people their ancestors shared this place with a very long time ago.
They are really short, and they have dark skin, like really dark skin, and some people say they have magic.
That's Awai Maya Titiong. Her mother's Saisiat and her dad's from New Zealand. She's been coming to the ceremony every 2 years since she was a kid. It's called the Pasta'ai. Now she's old enough to start helping out. That includes helping outsiders like me not offend the Kokota'ai.
Everyone will have to be careful and cannot have bad mood and cannot fight with each other and cannot throw stones at an empty place because they might hit the spirits.
For several days, the Saisiat welcome the spirits of the Kokota'ai into their village. They dance from evening till morning, offer millet wine and food, and sing songs that contain the knowledge the Kokota'ai gave to their ancestors.
The 16th song includes all the traditional plants that we have. And so Kokota'ai, they come and then they teach our people how to grow the millet and then also how to weave.
But tradition says the Kokota'ai also have a mischievous side. A Saisiat volunteer wraps silver grass around my arm, protection from harmful spirits. I keep silver grass tied around my sound recorder the whole weekend. Apparently, the Kokota'ai have wiped memory cards before. Until recently, most of what we knew about the Da'ai came from stories. Atao Apong is an elder and a former school principal.
Long time ago, we live in this mountain.
A long time ago, he says, our ancestors lived on this mountain. One day, they started hearing strange noises, possibly music. Some of the Saisiat people realized they were songs coming from a neighboring group of people, the Da'ai. We realized we could learn a lot from each other, he says. They taught us skills like weaving and how to plant crops. Unfortunately, the good times didn't last forever. So the story goes, some of the Saisiat women started getting unwanted attention from the Da'ai. One day, when the Da'ai came to our village, he says, some of us made a large cut in the bottom part of the tree the Da'ai used as a bridge to cross the river back to their home. When the Da'ai tried to cross the tree bridge to go back home, it collapsed. They fell to their deaths in the river. After this, life got tough for the Saisiat. Rains would either be extra heavy or not come at all. Babies were dying. Crops failed. Eventually, two of the surviving elders of the Da'ai appeared at the Saisiat village, he says. They told the Saisiat the only way to stop what's happening was to hold a ceremony to remember the Da'ai spirits every 2 years. It's hard to say how long ago this happened, but since then, without fail, the Saisiat have honored their promise. Many indigenous groups in Taiwan have stories about similar peoples. In the Philippines, right next door to Taiwan, there are ethnic groups that slightly match descriptions of the Da'ai, like the Ayeta people of Luzon. Researchers sometimes call these groups Negritos, a term that comes from Spanish colonization. But for the longest time in Taiwan, there wasn't any physical proof Negrito peoples lived here, just stories. That changed thanks to a team led by Taiwanese archaeologist Hung Xiaochun at Australian National University. As an undergrad at National Taiwan University over two decades ago, Hung remembers seeing a 6,000-year-old human skeleton at the Anthropology Museum. I saw it was very small and broken, she says. It was placed alone in a display cabinet. Every time I saw it, I always had this indescribable, special feeling. 3 years ago, Hung finally went back with the team and compared these bones with a huge database of known human populations. The closest living match to the bones, she says, are the Negrito peoples in the Philippines. It was the first physical evidence that Taiwan was once home to a group similar to the Negrito peoples. Hung says, based on the evidence available, these people arrived in Taiwan at least 7,000 years ago, and they could have been around as recently as the 1700s or the 1800s. For Hung, it's case closed. These Negrito peoples were the basis for the Da'ai story. But she's not the only researcher involved, and not everyone's so confident.
I think it's important to point out that I'm not in any way stating that there were a sizable population of Negrito people in Taiwan, and they are the origins of the Coco Da'ai story.
That's Toby Openshaw, a filmmaker and researcher who's been working with indigenous communities in Taiwan for over a decade.
For me, it was really just before we had no evidence of anything in that direction, now we have something.
Openshaw co-edited a book called Seeking the Coco Ta'ai. It pulls together Hong's findings alongside all the latest research into who the people in these stories could have been. We actually went to this year's Pas Ta'ai together. On the drive back to Taipei, I asked Openshaw about why it's so hard to prove the stories one way or the other. The answer's got a lot to do with Taiwan's hot, humid climate.
So bone material tends to decay very, very quickly here. And that's why we only have a few places where we have archaeological finds that are over 5,000 years old.
But Openshaw says, regardless of the evidence, stories like these show Taiwan's indigenous peoples already know they weren't the first people to arrive on the island.
In Taiwan, the indigenous people recognize that they were not the first humans in Taiwan. That's accepted and recognized. So they do not say, we were here first. They just say, we were here before you.
By you, of course, he means the Han Chinese, who make up over 90% of Taiwan's population. The elder, Atao Abong, also isn't interested in proving the story one way or another. We don't really want to dig deep into it, he says, because at the end of the day, we know the story. If we take a scientific approach, trying to prove things one way or another, what if our people start dying? As far as we're concerned, if there's no Pas Ta'ai, there will be no Saisiat people. On the last day of the apology ritual, dozens of Saisiat elders gather at the river where they believe the Da'ai drowned so long ago. An elder thanks the Da'ai for visiting and promises to see them again in 2 years. For The World, I'm Ashish Valentine, the village of Ufeng, Taiwan.
You're listening to The World. This is The World. I'm Carolyn Beeler.
And I'm Marco Werman. There's a line in the Talmud, one of Judaism's most sacred texts. It says, a person is only forgotten when their name is forgotten. That line stuck with a German artist named Günter Demnig.
About 30 years ago, Demnig started engraving names onto small brass-plated stones, each one honoring a victim of the Holocaust, and placing them outside their last known home. He called them Stolpersteine, or stumbling stones. Today, there are more than 100,000 scattered across Europe.
But not everyone agrees they should be there. That's something reporter Rebecca Rossman found out after a family friend, David Bliss, invited her to Germany. He was going to a small town called Husen to commemorate his great-aunt Bertha with a Stolperstein. He said it might be a good story. He was right, but not for the reasons either of them expected. Here's Rebecca with more.
In the spring of 2023, my dad's friend David sent me a message. He said he was planning a trip to Germany, something about his great aunt Bertha and a stone being laid in her honor. At first, I wasn't convinced, but he kept pushing. So I got on a train from Paris.
No, this way.
And what I discovered when I got there was much bigger than I expected. We're in a high school auditorium in Husen, Germany. It's a small town near Dortmund. Students file onto stage with violins and cellos. Others read poems.
It is a great honor for me to be able to open this extraordinary event today. At a time when not only wars raging, but also anti-Semitism and xenophobia are still part of society.
A letter is read aloud, as if it's from Bertha herself.
My name is Bertha Wolf, and I'm from Husen.
I was born here in 1879. I have 6 siblings, and I'm the youngest member of the family.
And there's David, sitting front row, watching high schoolers, most of whom aren't Jewish, read about a woman none of them ever met. This is not how ceremonies usually go. It turns out, Bertha had sparked something here.
Thank you so much for everything that you've done. You've reconnected us to our aunt, Aunt Bertha, of whom we knew, honestly, very, very little, and who we got to know much, much better.
David is in his mid-70s. He lives just outside Chicago. And for most of his life, his great-aunt Bertha was a ghost, a name his mother mentioned once or twice. He says it was like a fog.
There was no color or context to Bertha's personality. It was only this very thin layer of information that she didn't make it out and she died.
He didn't even know where she died. She had no children and was never married. Then a few years ago, David retired, and like a lot of people, he started looking backward, pulling on this thread. He filed a request for a Stolpersteine to be made in Bertha's name.
My name's Philipp Urban. I'm organizing the Stolpersteine project here in the city of Dortmund.
When David contacted the Stolpersteine program, this man Philipp began researching Bertha's history on his behalf. But it turned out somebody did know Bertha's story. A group of high school students in Husen had been researching the town's Jewish residents for decades, and Bertha was a main character.
And here's the weird thing about it was that the school kids in the 1990s and 2000s knew about her, knew way more than we did. And they were investigating her, and we didn't know it. They didn't know that we existed.
With Bertha, we were quite early on able to reconstruct her life or parts of it, parts of personality traits, which makes it way more of a person. That was something special.
It turned out Bertha ran her own shop in the town, something rare for a woman in those days. She was known for her generosity, often letting people pay on credit. The students in Husen discovered this and other details about Bertha. They put all this information into a report, which they called the Glass Book.
The Glass Book representing the fragility of life at the time, because it could be broken and shattered instantly without it taking much for that to happen.
They compiled newspaper clippings, photographs, even an old ad Bertha had placed for her shop. In 1938, during Kristallnacht, the night of broken glass, Nazi stormtroopers drove a truck through the front of Bertha's store. It was part of a coordinated assault against Jewish business owners that the SS staged across Germany. They threw her fabric into the street, ransacked the apartment upstairs, took her customer ledger. She survived that night, but not what came next. In 1942, Bertha was deported to Sobibor concentration camp. David recently found out from the students' research that she died along the way in Zamosh, Poland.
The thought that this 63-year-old woman in 1942 died alone pains me terribly.
Mm-hmm. To finish off the ceremony, we take a short walk from the school to Bertha's old house. About 100 others have joined us now. This includes residents, a small delegation of students from Poland, a journalist writing a feature for the local paper. Then the big moment arrives. Gunter Demnig, the artist, pulls up in his van to place Bertha's stone. He's carrying a bucket of tools in one hand and Bertha's stone in the other. It's a 4x4-inch cube with a brass inscription on its face.
But what are you going to do?
Well, I want to install a so-called Stolperstein to remember a victim of the Nazis.
Demnig measures out his spot with chalk, breaks into the ground, then delicately places and seals Bertha's stone in the street in front of her house. The whole thing is over in about 15 minutes. Then a prayer is said in Bertha's honor.
God of mercy, let her find refuge in your eternal presence and let her soul be bound up in the bond of everlasting life. God is her inheritance. May she rest in peace. And let us say, Amen.
Several months after the Stolpersteine was laid for Bertha, I traveled south to a city where these little brass plaques don't exist. Munich, the birthplace of the Nazi Party. Here, Stolpersteine are banned. They're not outlawed by federal law, but the city refuses to allow them on public property. The official reason? Respect.
You have a lot of people object to the notion of having the memory of their loved ones, their relatives, desecrated by people stepping on them.
Richard Volkmann is the spokesperson for the Jewish community of Munich and Upper Bavaria.
Having all kinds of basically dog poop on it, which is a possibility. People just drop their ice cream on it. That's all the possibility. And that isn't a bug. It's a feature of the project. I mean, he wanted people to step on it. That's the stumble on it. That's the name of the project. And while I see the artistic value, there are some obvious practical shortcomings.
Ultimately, Volkmann says the Jewish community in Munich advised against the Stolpersteine project. And the city came to the same conclusion after a long and painful debate. Maximilian Strand oversees the city's research and plaque ceremonies. Instead of Stolpersteine, Munich installs gold plaques to honor Jewish people killed in the Holocaust. They're placed at eye level, mounted on buildings.
What is also different, we have the pictures on it, if we have pictures. So this is also really emotional, I would say, that you can look them in the eye on eye level.
There are now more than 230 of these signs in Munich, with another 170 in the works. I followed a group of high school students as they installed new plaques in front of several homes across the city. A small crowd had gathered with them, including a retired woman named Monica.
It's the first thing we can do here in Munich to be against racism.
She told me she didn't know just how many Jewish families once lived in her own neighborhood.
We live in Nymphenburg, and Nymphenburg was one of the center of the NS times. And I didn't know this. And I think it's great to know more about and more about the history of the Jewish community here in Munich.
She says sometimes when people walk by the plaques, they look up, they ask questions, and then a conversation starts.
There really isn't a one-size-fits-all kind of answer to how to memorialize, and that's the important thing.
And yet, some still see Munich's approach as too cautious.
So, these are passport pictures from...
I met up with David Simon, a local historian and guide. Everyone calls him Taff, after the River Taff in Wales, where he's originally from. He takes me on a tour of what he describes as Munich's hidden Holocaust memorials. Murals painted in alleyways, commemorative plaques placed out of sight.
So this was put up, we have a little plaque here.
He shows me one of those plaques for the so-called 1938 Munich Agreement, when Germany annexed part of Czechoslovakia. The plaque is placed next to an unused building entrance.
This is, I think, a very deliberate policy of having a memorial, but not wanting people to really recognize it. There's so much shame attached to the history here.
Then there's also the parts of Munich's Nazi past that are still on display. He points to an eagle from the Nazi era still perched above the city hall, its swastika removed, but the rest untouched.
We'll see on the wall here, there's an eagle, another eagle here, again, without swastika.
A sign, he says, that the city still has a long way to go when it comes to reconciling with the darker side of its past. Before I left Munich, Taff and I sat down for a beer in Augustiner, the city's oldest brewery dating back to 1328. I asked him why this question, how we memorialize, is so loaded. He said part of it is because of the weight memorials carry.
I think memorializing is very important. As an historian, we don't just study dates for the sake of studying dates. We should learn from history.
And memorials like Stolpersteine force questions, uncomfortable ones. And that's the point.
You walk down one street and there'll be scores of these things. You think, my God, people lived here. They had neighbors and they knew what they saw was going on. What do the neighbors think? Did they try and stop them?
Maybe these are questions that not everyone is capable of confronting, he says.
So that's just my opinion, and you know, we've all got opinions on this sort of thing.
In Munich, memory lives on walls. In Husen, it lives in the street. And that difference, according to Taff, says a lot about how Germany is still wrestling with its past. Nearly 2 years after Bertha's Stolpersteine was laid in Husen, I visit David Bliss again, this time at his home in Wilmette, a leafy suburb just north of Chicago. A lot has happened since then. On October 7th, 2023, Hamas militants invaded Israel, killing more than 1,200 people. Over 50,000 Palestinians have been killed in Israel's subsequent war on Gaza. The aftermath has stirred not just global outrage, but rising anti-Semitism, Islamophobia, and for many, confusion. I asked David if that day changed how he thought about this entire memorial project.
My sense of my aunt Bertha's Stolpersteine is that it is even more important than it was before. There has been obviously been a lot of heated rhetoric and an increase in anti-Semitism and prejudice and racism. And I think those conversations and those feelings have risen even closer to the surface than they were before.
For David, never forget is a warning that extends to all people. All this has gotten David thinking about what happens next, not just to Bertha's legacy, but more generally, how we continue to remember the past and how it can teach us about today. Last year, Bertha's old home in Husen went up for sale. David tells me he bought it and is turning it into a nonprofit, a community center focused on Holocaust education and remembrance. David says the work has been gratifying, but he admits he's not sure who's going to carry the project forward. I ask about his two adult children.
Do my kids have the same feelings about it as I do? The answer is, in a general way, they do, but they don't feel it as strongly as I do. They don't have the same kind of intense feelings that I do. I just wish they did, but they don't.
He wants to understand why. But he has a guess.
I think they just feel like it's too far removed from their daily lives.
And so he continues on, driven in part by a worry that many like Bertha could still be forgotten, that there may not be anyone to pass on her story once he's gone.
People like my Aunt Bertha will be just lost to history. There will be a plaque in the ground. It will say, Bertha Wolf lived here, was born in 1879, died in 1942 on the way to Sobibor. But people won't know anything else about it.
For David, remembrance isn't about a stone in the sidewalk. It's about what people do next.
You have to fight for it, and you have to be watchful. You have to take those risks. If you don't take those risks, you're left with lives being disrupted for generations to come.
Back in Husen, on the same day Bertha's Stolpersteine was laid in June 2023, David held a second, smaller ceremony in Bertha's old backyard, this one just with his family. They're standing on a quiet patch of grass, holding a time capsule. Inside, a wooden hanger from Bertha's shop, a flag of Israel, artwork from David's granddaughter. and a piece of rug, not just any rug, a piece of rug that Bertha had donated to a local church in the 1930s. It was handed to David on this trip. Two students raise their violins. They begin playing Leonard Cohen's Hallelujah.
When another generation of children asked the questions that had eluded us, her memory stood alone. We were nowhere to be found. 82 years later, we stand in your garden once more.
David takes the shovel so they can bury the time capsule. The first scoop of dirt in Jewish tradition is done with the shovel upside down. It's a symbol of grief, a sign that this act is not easy. One by one, family members step forward to place more dirt. Some cry, a few say nothing at all, and then softly, a final voice cuts through the breeze.
Walk no more alone, dear Bertha. Walk no more alone. We love you, now and forevermore. Amen.
In the end, Bertha didn't disappear. She wasn't erased. Her name is now in the street, her story in a school, her memory sealed beneath the soil she once walked. And maybe that's what remembrance is, not a monument, but a chorus of people choosing over and over not to forget. Yeah.
Rebecca Rossman with that story from Germany, reported for this Memorial Day special.
This is The World. I'm Carolyn Beeler. The song Amazing Grace is a powerful musical memorial. Many of us, I'd bet, have specific memories of singing it for someone we've lost. There are similar pieces all over the globe played in honor of the dead. In Ukraine right now, funerals are common because of the war. The official death toll is a closely guarded secret, but according to estimates, some 100,000 Ukrainians have died as a result of the conflict. Reporter Emily Johnson in Kyiv has this story about how Ukrainians are turning to their own musical traditions for comfort.
It's a sunny day, and two hearses lead a procession through Lviv's cobblestone central plaza, known as Market Square. Outside the town hall, a musician in a red uniform is waiting for them, with his head bowed and a trumpet in his hand. Mourners and passers-by sink to their knees. Many are in uniform. Two soldiers are being laid to rest today. Yuri Teodor Suznivsky and Dmytro Manayev. Both are sons of this city. Yaroslav Simky is playing a song commonly mistaken for taps, but it's an Italian melody called Il Silenzio by Nini Rosso. Once, his job was simply to play at certain times of day, from a window high up in the town hall. But he's been playing funeral processions here in the square since Russia's full-scale invasion in 2022. At first, it was about four times a week. But these days, his only day off is Sunday, and he's sometimes asked to play twice in a day. He says it hasn't gotten easier with time. You don't get used to it, he says. For Simkiu, playing the song isn't the hard part. It is very difficult to live through this, he says. It's not difficult to play. And they are young people who would have been the future of Ukraine. He's no stranger to playing at military funerals. He served for 20 years playing in the military orchestra here in Lviv during the Soviet era. Ukrainian music was forbidden at funerals during the war in Afghanistan in the 70s. They'd play the Soviet national anthem, and a salute would be fired. I meet Ludmila Ivanikova at a church in Kyiv, where a number of folk musicians have gathered to play after the service. She wears a scarf over her hair, as is customary for women in a place of worship. Ivanikova is a folklorist who studied Ukrainian music traditions for 40 years. She says they've served as an important through line throughout its troubled history. She says some distinctly Ukrainian musical traditions have revived in recent years as people have mourned loved ones lost to Russian aggression. Traditions like the Holosinya, a folk lament. In the 80s and 90s, the Holosinya was starting to fade in the villages, she says. But what struck me when the war broke out in 2014, she says, when they started bringing dead soldiers back from Donbass, then the people's lamentations began to revive en masse. Another folk tradition having a resurgence is the music of the Kobzars. As far back as the 16th century, they were wandering bards who played a variety of uniquely Ukrainian instruments, like the 12-stringed kobza and the bandura, which can have dozens of strings. It's only recently that modern-day kobzars are being asked to play at funerals. They often play songs known as dumi, epic poems that tell of Ukrainian history and past battles. These songs have a very archaic, deep character, she says, and they touch the most subtle, deepest aspects of the human soul and the Ukrainian soul. Vitaly Kobzar, whose last name is a happy coincidence for a Ukrainian musician, plays an example of a duma. The instrument in his hands is one he made himself out of willow. He says it took him 1 year, 6 months, and 22 days to complete it. When the Soviet Union was here, they started using brass bands at funerals, he says. But Ukrainian funerals never had anything like that before. We need to return to our own musical traditions. Outside the church, the small crowd that's gathered to hear the music buzzes with excitement. One of the musicians playing today is Taras Kompanichenko, kobzar, bandura player, leader of the band Karaya Kozatska, and junior sergeant in the armed forces. Kompanichenko is in uniform as he plays. He plucks the strings with fingernails that have been lacquered into picks. In this piece, he sings of a young woman waiting for her love and of the sound of howling guns and of drones. He joined the military in February 2022, days after the invasion.
Kobzar I dosi.
The kobzar is still a mythological figure in Ukrainian culture, he says. We want kobzars to fulfill the same functions that they did in ancient Ukrainian culture, to awaken people's dignity, knowledge of Ukrainian history, admiration, interest, and universal values. Kompanichenko was born and raised here in Kyiv, and playing folk instruments was rare enough that his classmates laughed at him for choosing the bandura over something like guitar. But his decision proved to be a prescient one. I play at funerals not only in times of war, he says. It was already one of my services. But the culture of Ukrainian burial is just as important as the culture of Ukrainian weddings, as the culture of Ukrainian baptisms. That is, the arrival of a person into the world and the departure of a person. Since becoming a soldier, he says, he's played many funerals, including for men in his own brigade. Someone said, we never thought that these songs, these historical songs, would be about us, he says. And these songs are about us. For The World, I'm Emily Johnson, Kyiv, Ukraine.
Emily's report first aired back in February.
We've spent this hour today looking at ways we memorialize events and people, how we say goodbye, and how we remember. Last fall, we bid farewell to the musician behind this track, Manuel Guajiro Mirabal. He's remembered as one of Cuba's greatest trumpeters.
If Mirabal's name does not immediately ring a bell, maybe one of his most famous projects will, the Buena Vista Social Club. Their 1998 album revived the careers of a number of aging Cuban musicians. It won them a Grammy, and a Wim Wenders documentary about the group got an Oscar.
Mirabal was also a key player with the Afro-Cuban All-Stars, as well as several orchestras throughout his decades-long career, before he died in October at the age of 91. His music lives on, though, and what better way to wind down the hour on this Memorial Day?
The World is a co-production of GBH and PRX, broadcasting weekdays from the Nan and Bill Harris studio and from the Department of Communication at UC San Diego. I'm Carolyn Beeler.
And I'm Marco Werman. Thanks so much for spending part of your holiday with us.
The World is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, a private corporation funded by the American people. From the Carnegie Corporation of New York, working to reduce political polarization through philanthropic support, for education, democracy, and peace. More information at carnegie.org by the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. MacFound.org. By the PRX Ambassador Council, whose members include Betsy Atwater in memory of Paul Atwater Connolly, Helen and Russell Pine, the Sarlo Family Foundation, and the Patchwork Collective. The World's theme music is composed by Ned Porter. The World is a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX.